6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Carl Magnus Palm, welcome. You have written a number of books on ABBA. I was looking at the Wikipedia page and I couldn't work out whether this was number 8 or number 9, but you've written or co-written or been involved with so many. How many ABBA books have you been involved with, and what number is this one?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you. I've lost count myself, but I think you know 8 or 9 or something like that, depending on how you count.
Okay, I want to start with you because you, I believe, are 57 years old.
That's true.
Yeah, which sort of, I mean, we're similar age, I say that, but I'm 8 years older than you, so there we go. Was that something? No, I'm actually not. I'm 6 years old. I'm making myself older. What a terrible thing to do. But we were brought up in similar eras, not exactly the same, you know. Obviously, my teenage experience is a bit before yours. But you were in your teenage years during the 70s, and you... I presume, in a sense, you know, you were a young child as the 70s came in. So can you tell me a little bit about the type of music your family listened to at that period and what the influences were on you as a young person before you sort of got your own influences yourself?
Well, the thing is, music was a big thing for me. Even from the, you know, age of 2, I'm not making this up. I skipped everything else that young children are supposed to do, and I went straight to the gramophone. And there's 8mm footage of me playing the record player at age 1 or 2 or something like that. For me, it all started with the Beatles. Even though I was born in 1965, I was a Beatles fan. While they still existed, so it was the Beatles, you know. My dad traveled a lot, and he bought albums on his trips. And so my oldest sister, she had the Beatles Revolver album, which sort of migrated into my collection eventually, because it transpired that I was this huge Beatles fan. And but to answer your question, my mother, she loved Italian music, Italian pop hits of the time, of the 50s and 60s and 70s. My dad was a jazz fan, but he didn't play jazz very much at home. But what we had was a lot of easy listening albums, Herb Alpert and My mother loved all those, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck type singers, that kind of thing.
So, I mean, that is effectively, I mean, the Italian music of the 50s, 60s and 70s is sort of Italian Schlager, isn't it? And the German music of that period was German Schlager. What was the music of the 60s, and what was the music scene in Sweden during the 60s?
Well, in the 60s, it was, like you said, Schlager, what we term Schlager. I mean, when the Germans say Schlager, they mean something very specific for you know, German music, like Oompa Boompa or very saccharine ballads, I guess. But for us, Schlager meant at the time, because once rock and roll had happened, it became a dividing point. So everything that wasn't rock and roll or pop, you know, that was Schlager. So we had a lot of that, you know, inspired by, you know, French music or Italian music or German. It didn't have a lot of rhythm and blues in it, let's put it that way. And so we had that, but we also had a lot of pop bands. Like, you know, Benny was in a band called the Hep Stars, which was Sweden's biggest band in the 1960s. And we had a thriving pop scene, actually. I think a lot of people who are interested in 60s pop music and stuff like that, they're kind of surprised by how many bands we had and how many of them were actually quite good, even though, you know, the English may not be perfect and the lyrics might be a bit strange sometimes. But in terms of performance and songwriting, was, you know, fairly good, high standard.
I mean, one of my go-to books for Sweden is this, I think it's called Made in Sweden, which is a sort of collection of essays about Swedish music over the years. And it has one about the dance bands of that era. Do you mean those type of bands? Because they had very specific tropes in a way that, you know, they had to have certain elements to be sort of considered in this area. Can you explain that to me?
Right. No, I was not speaking about them. Right. That was something that became big in the 70s, more like. The dance bands, dance band, as we call them here, which is completely, you know, when you see when you think of a dance band, you see a big orchestra and you know, a conductor and a vocalist and you know, people. This is different. This is Schlager based, and it's usually very, shall we say, kind of mild, verging on the bland and maybe crossing the line into bland quite often. It's not very highly regarded in this country by critics and stuff, but it's very, very popular. You know, in the 70s, it was ABBA sold more records than anyone else, but then number two were some of these dance bands. So it's very... it's very hard to explain. Once you hear it, you understand what it is. But it is Schlager based. It's very very nice, very non-threatening melody based music. A lot of influences also from American country music, things like that.
But I was trying to work out when I was reading that whether there was a connection, because these tropes that I mentioned are, as you say, non-threatening. They were non-political. They were sort of happy music. They were melodic type, you know, positive type music. And also in terms of their look, they often dressed up as well, didn't they? So in some way. And I just wondered whether the you discovered whether the roots of ABBA sort of come from that or are influenced by that, or it is something completely different?
It does in a way. They I would say that the dance bands and ABBA, have the same roots in you know, old type Schlager music, 50s and 60s style, and then developing that into the 1970s. And if you listen to some of the early ABBA tracks, they were, you know, a bit like the dance band music of the time. And it's no coincidence that the dance bands love doing ABBA covers. You know, they really went for them. You know, this will work and this one will work. I do. I hope I got that right. That song is like is like what you would hear dance bands in Sweden play at the time.
So when was the moment that you heard an ABBA song, and what song was it?
I was a pop music fan from a young age. So I actually heard People Need Love, their very first single. I do remember that. We were on holiday and it was on the radio. It was the summer of 1972. I was 7 years old. So that was the first time I heard ABBA. And I thought, wow, you know, this was a nice song. You know, you're 7 years old. You don't analyze it beyond that, really. So I really like that, yeah.
Just before we go from your childhood to this, I want to sort of mention the fact that when I was a teenager, you know, my hero was Bowie. You talked about the Beatles, and then, of course, your interest in ABBA as well. My hero was Bowie, and it was not just his music. It was about what he represented, which is sometimes when you're a teenager, you know, that your family is something that you want to get away from. I don't mean that totally negatively, but I think all teenagers go through that phase. And for me, Bowie represented a world, and particularly as a gay man, Bowie represented a world for me where I could go into and be who I really was. And so it meant more for me. Which was the band for you that represented this other world for you, or did it represent anything like that?
Well, the thing was, you know, it started well for ABBA and me back in 1972, and we kept in touch through 1973 because I got the Ring Ring single for my birthday. But then I sort of, you know, went away from ABBA, and, you know, as you may know, there was a very, very negative, a lot of negative press towards ABBA in this country, and you weren't supposed to like them. And I was a Beatles fan anyway, so for me it was Paul McCartney and Wings. I mean, we're talking about this is pre-teen now. My teenage year started in 1979, so towards 78, so towards the end of the ABBA period, really. To answer your question, though, I was a Bowie fan. I was a Bowie fan as a young child. So for him, he was a very important artist for me in the 1970s. But by the time I got into that period of, you know, the teenage years when you try to suss out who you are and you want to, like you said, break free from your family and be something else, I would say, generally speaking, the synth pop bands, you know, I started listening to the Human League before they became really big, and the Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, you know, those kinds of bands, and also, you know, post-punk, whatever that is, you know, Elvis Costello I liked for a while, Simple Minds, The Associates, was a really, really big band for me. I think probably it might have something to do that they weren't, you know, they weren't among the biggest, so I can have them a little to myself, you know.
Sounds like we have an equally dysfunctional childhood there, because I love Billy McKenzie. Okay, let's get back to your book, this ABBA at 50. There's a little bit about your childhood there, and this covers the 50 years of ABBA's existence, in the sense when they started singing in English. For you also write about their early years in the book, and, you know, some of the stories are completely amazing. Can you take me through the individual members and what their experiences were in their early years?
Well, all of them started with music really early. Bjorn was, you know, he grew up in a town called Västervik, which is on the east coast of Sweden. And he, you know, I think he was 11 or something when he got his first guitar. I don't remember exactly, you know, he was playing skiffle and stuff like that. That was popular in the 50s. Then he joined a band called the, well, that's, got the name eventually the Hootenanny Singers, which he hates and hated even at the time, and who can blame him? They were into American folk music. They got a record contract when Bjorn was 18, and they immediately had a big breakthrough, and that's what he did during the 60s. You know, they went from this American-influenced folk music and then started doing schlager and stuff. Benny was born in 1946, also, you know, started playing the accordion at age 5 or 6 or whatever, started playing the piano at age 10. And music was immediately became the thing for him. That was, you know, that was the only thing he was really, really interested in. He was 17 or 18 when he joined the Hep Stars, another wonderful group name. And they soon after that, they became very, very big, you know, had lots of number one hits. He started writing songs, and that was also a turning point for him. You know, when he wrote a song called Sunny Girl, which became a big number one hit here in Sweden. And that's when he sort of realized, OK, this is what I'm going to do with my life, write music. Then you have Frida, who has, you know, completely different background. The other three members of ABBA had kind of safe middle class or lower middle class upbringings. But she was, you know, the offspring of a German soldier from the occupying forces in Norway. And her mother was a teenage girl. So this was a liaison that was frowned upon, you could say.
Was it a liaison, though? I read about this, that it was really horrendous that the German soldier had offered her a bag of potatoes. It was food to, you know, because there was no food.
Yeah,
basically. Yeah. And so it's a very dark, terrible story in a way.
It is. I mean, they sort of fell in love, I think. So it was, you know, a bit more than that. It wasn't just a one-night stand. They saw each other several times. But then he went back before Frida was born, long before Frida was born. He left Norway, and they thought for many, many years that he had perished. And he only emerged when Frida was famous, you know, in 1977. She was 32 years old. She found out that she actually had a father, and they connected through this German teen pop magazine called Bravo, which was huge back in those days, which is also completely surreal. But anyway, it was hard for them, for her mother and her grandmother. There was a rumor that her grandmother had also been in cahoots with some German soldiers. So they had to leave Norway for Sweden before Frida was, she was 1 year old, you know, 1 year old or something like that. And then tragically, Frida's mother died at age 21. So she had to be brought up by her grandmother here in Sweden. And, you know, they were rather poor, but, you know, they had food and they had clothes and all that, but they didn't live a luxurious lifestyle. But she, for Frida, it was the same as with the others. She sang, you know, from an early age. And also just, you know, when she was 13, she started singing with a dance band, a different type of dance band than the ones we discussed earlier. And from then on, it was just music, 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 music. That was what she lived for. She married early, had children as a teenager and so on. But she, you know, the music was the most important thing. And then she had a breakthrough in 1967. So that's when she became known in this country. And then Agneta, finally, she was born in 1950. And also she started playing the piano at age 5, I think, and wrote her first song when she was 6 years old. She started writing her own more and more songs in her teens. And she started singing with a dance band. And Agneta recorded a song that she had written herself. She was 17 years old, and the song was called Jag var så kär, which translates as I was so in love. And that went to number one in Sweden. And for people who might not know what a sensation that was, it was very unusual in the 1960s that girls were songwriters, and even less so that they were 17 years old and wrote for themselves as performers and became and that became number one hits. So she had like a really good start to her career, let's put it that way. So those are the backgrounds of the four members.
Now, so where did Stig Anderson come into the story? It was with Benny and Björn, first of all, wasn't it? When they got together, and then I think Stig Anderson brought them to his label.
Yes. Stig, the relationship starts with Björn and Stig, because the Hootenanny Singers were signed to Stig's record company, Polar Music. So that's where it all starts. So they had a relationship. And then a few years later, in 1966, Björn and Benny meet. They hit it off. They realize, okay, you're interested in writing songs. Oh, I'm also interested in writing songs. Let's try to write a song together, which they did very soon after. A song called Isn't It Easy to Say that was recorded by the Hep Stars. It wasn't the world's best song, but it was the start to this. And by 1968, 1969, something like that, they had more or less decided, okay, we're gonna be a team, because the Hep Stars had split up and things were cooling off with the Hootenanny Singers. So they had to think about the future. That's what the future they envisioned was: the songwriters behind the scenes and, you know, producers, not to be performers. Stig, to answer your question about Stig. So Stig recognized their talent. So he went into partnership with them. Eventually, he hired them as record producers for his Polar Music label. So Stig, Björn and Benny, they were kind of like a team.
What sort of person was Stig? Because when I read about him, there is a sort of another side to him in a lot of ways, it seems.
Yeah, there are plenty of sides to him. He was a very unusual person. He was everything you would want in a manager, because he was aggressive. He the word no didn't exist for him. And when people say, you know, we can't possibly, no, that wouldn't work. And he would say, why not? Let's try it. There's no reason this wouldn't work. But he was also very short-tempered, very hot-tempered, and in many ways, a difficult person to deal with. But, you know, those around him kind of got used to him and his his moods and the kind of person he was.
He also was a lyricist, wasn't he? In the sense that he used to go to New York and find tracks and translate them on the plane coming back, I read. And so he would, and then, you know, adapt them, I suppose, to make them work in Swedish. So he was more than just a manager, wasn't he, to his artists?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, he had roots in music as well. He also started early, you know. He wrote the first song he wrote that would become a hit. He was 16 when he wrote that. And he had been a performer himself. So he knew that side of the business. He wasn't just, you know, a bean counter. You know, he was someone who knew what it was to write songs and what it was to be an artist. And in the early 60s, he started a publishing company. And like you said, he started doing this thing with translating, foreign hits and you know, writing Swedish lyrics. And hopefully it was recorded by someone who could make a hit out of it. And usually they were.
Yeah, because he was more powerful than just the manager in a lot of ways. He was involved in the Sphinx Poppen TV show, wasn't he? That was the music show in Sweden. So automatically, by knowing him, I mean, obviously there has to be talent and a song and everything else, but automatically he had the power to make people successful in Sweden.
Absolutely. I mean, if, it's interesting. I mean, he was ABBA's manager formerly, but what he really was, he was the head of the record label. He was the head of the publishing company. And he was, so they had the package that he didn't have to bring his band to another record company and say, would you please sign them? They already had, everything was in place. All those things were in place. And you know, Svensktoppen, he, you know, he, they called him the king of Svensktoppen because sometimes like more than half the songs on the chart were, had lyrics by him.
That's amazing. So we've got Benny and Bjorn at Polar Music working with Stig Andersson or under Stig Andersson, you know, and then of course the girls need to come in. So can you tell me about how they got to Polar and eventually into ABBA?
Yeah, what happened was in 1969, Bjorn was on the west coast of Sweden to do a television special, and Agneta was also on that television special. And they had met before, and Bjorn had sort of, you know, I like that girl. And now he had a chance to, you know, he made his move. And so they fell in love really quickly. I think they moved in together just a couple of months later. And a similar thing happened to Benny and Frida around the same time. They were on the same radio show and they, you know, blah, blah, blah. They went out to dinner and they were also living together very soon and got engaged and all that. So those two couples were established pretty quickly in 1969. Then what happened was that the first thing they did was a thing the following year in 1970, because everyone was doing cabaret at the time, all the Swedish artists who were in the sort of middle of the road area, which the ABBA members, all four of them certainly were, they did these cabaret shows. Everyone should do them. So what was that? Well, they sang a few songs, then they played a few skits, and the songs should have funny lyrics. There should be like a twist and, you know, that kind of thing. And apparently this show was a bit of a disaster. They had like five people in the audience sometimes. And it was like, okay, now we know what we should not do. This is not for us. We should do something else.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
It seems strange to me that two couples would decide to record music together. And I say that only because if you want to bring sort of a strain to a relationship, it often when you work together. Were they all in agreement about this, or did anybody need to be convinced? Were there any initial sort of, I don't know, initial problems that anybody had about working together?
Well, if you read interviews from 1969, the year when they met, you could see that Bjorn and Agneta were like, you know, well, we better not work together. That would be too much, because I think they'd probably recognize that they were both kind of stubborn and kind of not always easy to get along with. So maybe they wanted to keep the work out of the relationship. And I think it was the same for Benny and Frida. And after that, you know, disastrous cabaret show, I think Benny and Frida almost broke up because the relationship was going downhill, and it had been really, really troublesome to work together. So they were like, well, let's see how this works out. But I think by the time they decided to record People Need Love in 1972, I don't think anyone had to be convinced. It was just like, well, let's try this and see how it works out.
How did they adopt the roles that they were eventually to have with Benny and Bjorn? You know, you mentioned that the both girls, I think, wrote their own music early on, and they were, so, you know, they had this creative push to them as well. But they seem to have adopted roles in ABBA that were, I wouldn't say completely split. That's what's interesting about your book, what you bring out in that. But the roles were to a certain extent split between the guys producing and writing the music and the girls singing. So how did that really come about?
Frida didn't write songs at the time, but Agnetha certainly did. She was quite a prolific songwriter. I think the thing is that ABBA started as a vehicle for Björn and Benny to write pop songs in English and become known abroad. That was the plan that Stig and Björn and Benny had. So the fact that the girls came into the picture, that was more like, well, this we'll use them when we record, but this is our project, more or less. That's how it started, and I think it continued like that. Agnetha had a song on the first ABBA album, Ring Ring, called Disillusion. But after that, she didn't write anything else, and Björn and Benny, it wasn't because Björn and Benny stopped her. On the contrary, they asked her, don't you want to write something? You know, you're a good songwriter. You could write something for us. And she had low self-esteem, and she thought, well, my songs aren't good enough, or they're not right for ABBA. And like you said, I think also the ladies were ladies of their time. You know, and probably the feeling I get is that they often would, defer to the guys. Oh, the men know, they know best. And we're, they had a lot of input, but at the end of the day, let the men control this and we'll do our bit. Whereas today, if it had been today, I'm sure Agnetha would have been more persistent in tried to offer them something at least.
I mean, you say ladies of the time. I mean, the other thing with that is that if you look historically in music, particularly how women were treated during the 60s, often, and I'm not suggesting this happened with ABBA, but I'm just asking the question, often they would have been ripped off, because if the guys were controlling the writing of the music, controlling the producing of the music, and the girls were singing, then the royalty split is really on the side of the guys. Was that the case with ABBA?
Yes. Yes, I think it was. They had an equal, as recording artists, the group ABBA, they had equal shares, obviously, in the royalties. But then Björn and Benny had a producer's royalty, and obviously as songwriters, they had additional income. But then from the mid 70s somewhere, they were, all four of them were part owners of the record company Polar Music. So the ladies were brought in. They were part of the business setup. But of course, in the long term, I'm sure the guys made more money.
Yeah. I think what, you said something very interesting about them, that their goal was to become, or Stig and Benny's goal, was it? You mentioned that their goal was to become international and to write music with lyrics in the English language and to become an international success. But it didn't work initially, did it? It actually took quite a long period.
It did, and that's why, whatever else he may have been, Stig Andersson, he was stubborn. He didn't give up. They had the first single, People Need Love. It was most countries said no to it. It was released in the United States on Playboy Records. Playboy magazine had a record label at the time, and they wanted this, and they put Björn and Benny with Svenska Flicka, which means Swedish girl. It was you can imagine what kind of images they were trying to conjure up with with the Playboy, and it climbed to number 114 on some charts, but it wasn't a hit really. And then they tried. So there were a lot of setbacks. Then the next year they had a song called Ring Ring in 1973, which they entered into Melodifestivalen, which is our selection to the Eurovision Song Contest. And everyone thought, wow, this song is so catchy, you know, and they were favorites to win. And it would be, you know, now is our chance here. And they finished third in Melodifestivalen. So obviously they didn't go to Eurovision, but they were vindicated because they had the biggest hit in Sweden that year. You know, forget Melodifestivalen, forget Eurovision. They had the biggest success of anyone in Sweden in 1973. So, and I think that was only then that they sort of decided, the four of them, that, oh, we should make this group permanent. We should go on working with this and phase out everything else.
I mean, in life, we learn from failure more than we learn from success. So in that sense, it wasn't a big failure, because you say that they had a massive hit from it, but they'd entered and they hadn't won. So they hadn't got through to Eurovision. And the next time they entered, they obviously had to make a lot of other choices based on what hadn't worked before. So what difference was that approach, and why do you think it worked?
Well, I think the main reason that it worked was that the jury system here in Sweden changed, because in 1973 it was a so-called expert jury, a jury of you know, people, music journalists and others, you know, songwriters, performers, people like that who were supposed to know music, and they favored a more complex song that was good, very good song, but less suitable for Eurovision. In 1974, you had a jury that consisted of, a cross-section of Swedish people, basically. And, you know, so they had that in their favor. But they also, I think Stig Andersen said, well, it was actually a good thing that we didn't make it in 1973, because it gave us another year to make us even more prepared. And this time they decide, well, we're not going to take any chances at all. So instead of, Agneta was dressed, she had a maternity blouse in 1973 when she performed Ring Ring on television. And this year they were all wearing these, outrageous glam rock costumes. And Bjorn had this star-shaped guitar. They were not taking any chances, visually. When they performed Waterloo.
But Stig had already gone to other European territories before with that song, hadn't he, to actually help get that known and so get the votes, I suppose, and get the interest. What did he do?
Yeah, well, what he did was that, Ring Ring became a big hit in this country, and Stig was actually able to sell that to a lot of countries in Europe specifically, and it became a hit. It was number one in Belgium and things like that. So when he came with Waterloo, he already had a relationship with record companies in these countries. So the moment they had won Melodifestivalen, the Swedish selection, or the day after, he went on a plane and he went, visited six countries in 2 days, I think. Went to all these record companies and said, here's Waterloo. This is what they look like. We're going to be in Eurovision. We're going to be wearing crazy costumes. Our conductor is going to dress up as Napoleon. We're going to make an impression. This song is great. And, so everyone was prepared. When they won with Waterloo then, it was like pushing a button, because he had prepared everything. Everyone in all these countries knew what they needed to do with this song. So that was really clever.
I remember, at that time, I think I was 15, and sitting at home with my mum watching TV. And when you consider everyone else who was in that show, suddenly this was like, it was so phenomenal, in contrast to what else was in there, and in contrast to even Katie Boyle, who was the host. It was such a different era. Do you know what I mean? And here came these sort of, in my terms at that point, glam rockers, because of their outfits. You know, they look like Sweet or, you know, a sort of band of that ilk. Can you remember the night that you watched it and how you felt watching that? What went through your head?
Oh, I do remember that. I do remember that. I thought it was great, obviously. I don't remember so much about my reaction to seeing it, because obviously I already knew what they looked like because I'd seen them on the Swedish selection. But I do remember, you know, shouting like, oh, Sweden won, Sweden won, Sweden won. And watching it today, of course, you can really tell how different they were from everybody else and from what had gone before. Like you said, you know, these glam rock costumes, and everyone else was, you know, wearing evening gowns or new tuxedos or some, you know, nondescript unisex type things, you know, and they looked like they meant business. Let's put it that way.
I talked to Madeline Bell recently from Blue Mink, and I think she mentioned you. She said a Swedish journalist said that Blue Mink were very influential to ABBA from their harmonies and so on and so forth. Can you explain that? Was that true? Did they look to Blue Mink or bands like that at the time?
They did. Well, their very first single, People Need Love, was inspired by Blue Mink, because what Blue Mink did was they had Roger Cook and they had Madeline Bell trading verses and then coming together in the choruses. And so Björn and Benny thought, wow, we could do something like that. That's nice. So that's what they did with People Need Love. But that type of music in general was what they were aiming for at that time, 72, 73. There was a group called Middle of the Road, you know, Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep and Sole Sole and all those hits. And possibly, the New Seekers, who had also been in Eurovision. So that kind of family friendly, but still poppy type of group. That was what they first. Well, we can do that. That's that was the first inspiration.
I mean, many people think of ABBA as, you know, just pop and so on, but their songs are actually sometimes quite complex. And Benny and Björn, the way they would create a song, and this tonal quality would change in the song. Can you explain what they used to do? Because that was part of their success to a certain extent, wasn't it? The way those songs worked.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to explain in words, but I mean, all I can tell you is that they worked really hard on them, and they wanted something. They were inspired by all sorts of things. You know, they didn't close the door to anything that appealed to them. You know, they liked Benny. In particular, loved classical music, so you can hear a lot of that in their pop music, but never to the extent that the classical influences took over. But it was there as a color. But their songwriting was completely intuitive. They just sat there. Oh, that's a nice melody line. Let's try to marry that melody line with this melody line and see if it becomes complete. Like you say, it's much more complex than you think. You think you listen to Mamma Mia and you think, oh, that's, you know, I could write that, but probably you couldn't because it's...
I don't think that.
No. No. Because it's so, it's much more, there are so many intricate things going on, and the way they balance the verses with the choruses and, you know, things like that.
Their success was also as a video band. Videos were obviously invented as promotion. And for them, it was a way, because they became successful in Australia, and of course they couldn't go to Australia every week and be on a TV show, they created a video. So how much importance do you put down to not only the visual aspect of ABBA, which you've, you know, mentioned a bit, but also in terms of their videos and how their videos express what we think about ABBA today.
Yeah. Well, in some countries, like in Sweden, for instance, those promo clips were hardly ever shown on TV. So here they had very little impact. But then if you go to a country like Australia, where it was like night and day, because they showed those promo clips, and it was the Mamma Mia promo clip that gave ABBA their big breakthrough there, and you know, had ABBA Mania and all sorts of stuff going on there. They became huge. I know Bjorn has said sometimes that in European countries, for instance, they weren't so keen to show the promo clips because they thought, well, you could actually come over. You could hop on a plane and do this TV show. I think maybe it's more in retrospect that it's colored our view of ABBA with these, Agnetha in profile and Frida, face on.
Well, not only that, but the fact is that they are a bit of an enigma. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I know them through their videos. I mean, okay, I've met Benny and Bjorn. I haven't interviewed the women, but I've interviewed the guys. And I don't know, or I haven't known, a lot about them. And this is something that I realized when I read your book.
Yeah.
That I'm finding out so much about ABBA that I didn't know, because almost like I've conflated the whole story in my head from articles and things over the years, but particularly from the videos and my feeling of what the interpersonal relationships are and how the songs reflect their lives and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean they did leave a lot to their audience to sort of imagine for themselves. In those videos, particularly the later videos like The Winner Takes It All, where everyone knows that Agnetha and Bjorn are real life divorcees, and here Agnetha is playing the lonely abandoned woman while the other three are laughing and having fun.
But that's heartbreaking to watch. Yeah,
it is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking. But that's how we learned about ABBA and who they were and how they felt about things, because they, particularly I think in interviews outside Sweden, they weren't particularly open-hearted. Maybe they didn't find it so easy to express themselves in English and whatever other language.
I think also that they were I remember watching them on British TV, and this was my idea of Sweden, you know what I mean? And you mentioned, Agnetha as the beautiful blonde Swede, that sort of fills that one. And then you've got the language and the sort of closedness, which is how people often have imagined what Swedes are like from outside. So they sort of fulfilled the cliche of Sweden to a certain extent, but they also, you never really found out anything about them in interviews.
No, they were. If you read Swedish interviews, you would have found out a lot more. But when you read or interviews, or when you listen to interviews on TV, and I mean the questions they were asked on British TV were often of not a very high standard. It was like, oh, you always dress so nice. What do you like wearing in your spare time? And things like that. It was just very, very, very strange line of questioning, because I think also maybe they were the type of artists that weren't expected to have anything interesting to say beyond what they were wearing. They must have seemed, I mean, and that famous picture on the Greatest Hits album, the park bench picture where you see Benny and Frida embracing and Agnetha and Bjorn sitting there like, oh, there's some trouble going on here. We're not very happy. I mean, people must have projected all sorts of fantasies on that, who's sleeping with who and what's going
on. But did they know that? Did they actually do that purposely? Were these things done? One of us is lonely. the day before you came. Do you know what I mean? Those videos really express the pain that you feel in, you know, yourself in a relationship when you have a breakup.
Yeah, I don't think they thought about that. I think they were very unaware of how they were perceived. I think their bugbear was that the people kept talking about the money all the time, all these other things.
Like Volvo were the biggest export and they were the second biggest export. Was that true?
No, not at all. The thing was that, not to be completely boring about this, but in simple terms, in percentage, Abbas Polar Music, their company, they had, in percentage terms, their profit was much bigger than Volvo's. So, and that was sensational, but in terms of, you know, dollars and cents, obviously Volvo was much, much bigger, and there were many companies that were much, much bigger than Polar and Abba.
Now, they didn't have outward, and I mean in the press, in my terms, maybe in Sweden they did, but they didn't have outward political opinions. They weren't, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll. They weren't, you know, the bands that I was used to interviewing. They weren't to that extent, and they were perceived as boring. But when I met Benny and Bjorn, they were highly interesting and highly entertaining and really nice people and fascinating. Did you find that with the band, that they had one perception to the outside world, which was a little bit boring, and something different, and I suppose not so conventional when you met them, because you must have met them so many times?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I haven't met the ladies many times, just a few times, but Bjorn and Benny I've met several times over the years, and they are not these, you know, bland people with no opinions. In fact, latterly, Bjorn has become this guy who writes these opinion pieces in the newspapers, and you know, he enters the debate on euthanasia, is that the word, about whether we should have physical money or not, religious issues, all sorts of things.
Immigration, when I talk to him, it's really at that period in Sweden, and he was saying, you know, everyone should come to Sweden. He was quite politically and socially aware and out there. And I found that incredibly positive for someone of his stature to be able to say that.
Absolutely. The thing was, back in the 70s, they felt, well, because we had a lot of political music in Sweden at the time, and they felt, well, you know, we don't want to get into that. We want to make music, and we want to sing about personal relationships, and that's all there's to it. And we don't want to shout our political opinions from the rooftops or anything like that. Because that was the tradition they were in as artists. If from the 60s, they were, we're entertainers, end of story. They weren't, you know, the Beatles or Bob Dylan or the Stones or anyone who came after them, who were like, you know, taking drugs and, experimenting with LSD or writing Give Peace a Chance, you know. Towards the end of Abba's career, you can hear that they become a bit more political. They write songs about the Cold War and about Soviet dissidents, and they even, you know, made some public statements about certain political issues. But you know, during the ABBA years, no, that wasn't on the agenda.
I mean, ABBA on LSD is going to be an image that I will never get out of my head.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customer
customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
But I want to come to the point where they were so successful. I mean, they really, you know, I mean, to be honest, it's grown and grown and grown. But there was the period in the first, let's say, the first incarnation of ABBA, up till about 82 or whenever it was that they just sort of went their separate ways. But there was a period where they were so phenomenally successful. How did each of them deal with that, those sort of pressures that fame bring?
I think for Björn and Benny, it wasn't too hard. They had been through it in the 1960s because both their bands were hugely popular. So they, you know, Screaming Girls, Autograph Seekers, you know, groupies to a certain extent, they'd all been through that kind of thing, that kind of adulation. So when it happened, this happened with ABBA or for ABBA in the 1970s, they had... I think Bjorn told me at once, you know, it was like the 60s, but bigger. That was the only difference. And also the girls were the focal point of the group. They were, you know, let's be honest, you know, if you asked anyone, who are your favorite members in ABBA, it would be Agnetha and Frida. And they don't care about the guys so much because of their sex appeal, and they were the lead singers and everything. And I think it was, particularly for Agnetha, it was hard because...
But she was objectified, wasn't she, in a lot of ways?
Oh, you
know,
absolutely.
Like best bum of the year or whatever, you know, those sort of things. And she was much more objectified than Frida. So that must have had an impact on her.
Absolutely. I mean, she was blonde. I guess she was the sexual fantasy of the, you know, the Swedish girl. She kind of with her blonde hair and everything, she was like, oh yeah, this is Swedish sin personified, you know. So people projected all kinds of things on her like that. And she also had, because she sang, I think also because she sang so many of those heartbreak songs like SOS and The Wind Takes It All and One of Us, you know, people kind of, oh, you know, she, oh, they're, you know, I want to protect her, you know, I can, oh, you know. Whereas Frida, Frida was more the regal diva, I think. She was a bit more like that. But it was, you know, for Agneta, she got more fame than she bargained for. That's my impression. It became too much for her. I mean, even before ABBA had their, you know, international breakthrough with Waterloo, there are interviews with her when she said, oh, you know, it's becoming so big. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, putting on a black wig and, you know, sunglasses just so people won't recognize me. And this is when they're famous in Sweden, nowhere else. And for Frida, I think she was more, because she hadn't really had any success before ABBA. So for her, it was like, wow, not success on the level that the others had. So for her, I think it was, wow, I'm famous, you know, and I love being on stage and it's so great. And she was out and about, she was clubbing, da da da, you know, she was a, you know, celebrity here and everything. But she also said afterwards that, you know, her relationship with Benny was so, it was like a part of the ABBA thing. So where does the relationship end and ABBA start? It was just part of the same thing. And she said afterwards that after ABBA, you know, she made a couple of solo albums, but then she felt, well, you know, I need to withdraw from the music business. I need to piece myself together, because what we went through was so, there was such a lot of pressure there. And, you know, her marriage breaking up, both their marriages breaking up while the group was still working and expected to, you know, be on TV and go on photo sessions and all that.
Can I ask you about Frida and just maybe give you an opinion, because I've interviewed so many pop stars over the years, and even in my own life, my father didn't have much contact with me, and my mother told me actually had nothing to do with me the first years, and I think that I ended up being on MTV because I was looking for some love. And if I draw a comparison between me and other people I've talked to and Frida, there is the possibility that maybe because of how she came into the world, the fact that her mother died and being brought up by a grandmother and all those things that she went through in her past, that maybe this was the substitute from the love that she never had, which is why she enjoyed it for a time and then it turned. Do you think that could be a possibility? Have they ever talked about stuff like that?
I'm not sure she has mentioned that, but if you look at her life story, it looks pretty obvious for me that, you know, she was looking for confirmation, and she was drawn to men who could be like father figures to her, in a sense. You know, part of the appeal of Benny, I think, was that he was so stable and grounded in himself. So yeah, it's definitely in her case, it was, you know, I seek confirmation. I you know, I want to be seen and heard, the love that I couldn't get from, because the relationship between her and her grandmother wasn't very physical. It was like, you know, okay, you have all the material comforts that you need, but they didn't have the, you know, mother-daughter relationship that she craved.
I mean, after ABBA and Frida had this, she had a very big success at the beginning. And then, of course, the second album didn't work. Agnetha went off and recorded as well. But Agnetha, later on, there is this horrendous story with the stalker, the German stalker that lived next door. And it's just such a bizarre story. Can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, he was a Dutch stalker, actually.
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
They're normally German. It's the Ace of Base one. I'm sorry, I live in Germany. I shouldn't say that.
Let's put the blame where it belongs. But seriously though, no. Well, he entered a relationship with her. He went to the area where he lives, and he rented a house close to her, and he started, you know, courting her, basically, buying flowers and writing letters, and she decided, okay, well, maybe he's a bit odd, but I'd like to get to know him, and apparently they started a relationship, and then eventually she realized, well, this is not going to work, So she broke it off, and that's when it turned, you know, nasty. And he wrote 84 letters or something to her, and he showed up outside her window, and she had to file a restraining order. She had to go to court to sort of get rid of him. So that was an odd period.
So let's get back to they've gone their separate ways. Each of them, you know, Benny and Bjorn have gone on to be successful with chess, and they've done those sort of things. And Frida and Agneta have, in a sense, they haven't gone into obscurity. I mean, Agneta chose a little bit of obscurity, I think. But Frida had a very different life. When did the point come where the first wave of ABBA being loved again suddenly rose up, and when did the point came for them where they decided, or they got much more involved in what the future of ABBA could be?
Yeah, I mean, the gay scene was where the ABBA revival started, because as we all know, a lot of ABBA fans who were certainly of my generation, born in the mid 60s, they grew up to be gay men, and they obviously recognized that in each other. So when they were in their 20s and they started going out to clubs, and probably maybe the DJs were their age, okay, so we play Gimme 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 Man After Midnight, you know, people are going to like that for several reasons, you know. and so it started in the late 80s, I think, and then you have the big year of 1992 with Erasure. Sure. And then, you know, your MTV interview with Bjorn and Benny, and, you know, ABBA Gold. So that's when it explodes. But I think they tried to keep a certain distance from it to start with, because, you know, they were like, well, Bjorn and Benny, certainly we've moved on. You know, that was, you know, we're proud of what we accomplished with ABBA, but that was pop music. Now we're writing serious musicals about, you know, the Cold War and you know, Swedish immigrants and blah, 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 blah. I think towards the late 90s, at least Bjorn and Benny started embracing it more, because Mamma Mia came along, the musical. And when that became huge, I think they realized, well, let's just embrace this. Let's be a part of this. Let's have fun with it and be proud of it and just go with the flow. For the ladies, I think it took longer to sort of accept that. I don't know, really, because I don't think they've talked about it so much, but I think they, you know, happy and proud and all that, but maybe, I mean, it's no coincidence, I think, that Bjorn and Benny have been the main spokesman for ABBA. It's always been them. You know, 9 times out of 10, it's been either Bjorn or Benny, usually Bjorn, talking to the media about ABBA, whereas the ladies have sort of kept a low profile.
But what, you know, that you mentioned that the gay community, you know, always loving ABBA, and not to disagree with what you say about the Gimme Gimme Man Out of Midnight, which is the fun aspect of like that, but it's about a lot of gay people really like the diva and what the diva represents, and also that the diva automatically, and I include Elton John in as the diva as well, has a tragic, in a sense, a tragic existence. And I think that sort of fed into not only the fact that the ladies in ABBA did have some sort of tragedy in their life and had that existence, but also that the songs represented the tragedy of love as well. So I think that the connection, in a sense, was much, much greater and much deeper.
Oh, certainly. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you want to talk in if you want to talk in terms of who they were, I mean, Agneta obviously was the Judy Garland of ABBA. You know, that you know, the sense of tragedy and the songs she sang was always, you know, and she, like, you know, people say that she was crying with her voice. All the lyrics, I mean, almost all the lyrics, that she was sad or she was desperate or she was completely devastated, you know. And then you had, had a bit more regal diva with Frida. There was heartbreak, but there was more resolve in the lyrics that she sang. You know me, know you. There's nothing we can do. We just have to face it. This is tragic, but we have to move on. So she's, if Agnetha was like, oh no, I give up, you know. their personas. Frida was more like, okay, this is tragic. My heart is broken, but I'm going to move forward. That kind of thing, which also, you know, appeals to a lot of gay men because it's the gay experience for certainly for our generations a lot of the time, you know, for various reasons. And then, you know, the other aspects is obviously the disco music and they had so many dance friendly tracks and, you know, the lyrics were about clubbing and picking up someone, on the dance floor and whatever else. But certainly I think the main appeal is Agnetha and Frida.
Have you got a few more minutes? Because I'd really love to carry on a bit.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
One of the fascinating things, I think, is after this split, of course, Benny and Björn go their separate way, as it were, and do their thing. And then you've got Frida and Agnetha. And the feeling is that there isn't any contact during that period. Is that true? Did they have occasional contact? Because if they were in charge of the rights and the record company, they must have communicated during that period.
Are you talking about Björn and Benny now?
No, all four of them, the group.
Right. Well, what happened was that they were part owners in the record company, all four of them. But by 1984, between 82 and 84, the four of them, you know, successively sort of one after the other sold their interests in Polar back to Polar, back to Stig. So all they had after that was, you know, royalty reports. That was their connection to ABBA as an entity. Björn and Agnetha, obviously, I mean, Björn moved to England, but Björn and Agnetha had two children together. So they obviously had contact through that. Frida was building her own new life. And my impression is that if she was in Sweden, she would say hello. She would come into the office, you know, Benny's offices, and say hello. I don't think, after the first few years, I don't think there was any bad blood, really. I think everyone, okay, you have a new partner and I have a new partner and everything is fine and we can still be friends. But they certainly didn't, I don't think they socialized in that sense.
Didn't they sue Stig Anderson at one point?
They did because, well, that's a long story, but what happened was, this was in 1990. And he was selling all his companies, the record company, the music publishing, everything. And when he did that, it was discovered that the royalty rate because they were on the 3% royalty rate. And there had been some negotiations back in 84 or something, I think, where it was agreed that they would have a higher royalty rate after that, after a certain date. And he hadn't, in their perspective, he hadn't honored that agreement. Whereas he said, well, that agreement was, based on the fact that, on the condition that ABBA would record together again, which they never did. So, well, you didn't do that. So I'm not going to, you're not going to get a high royalty rate. So there was a dispute about that and it had to be resolved in court. So that was a really sad and sorry end to their relationship.
I went to the Dennis Pop Music Awards. When would that have been? About 6 months ago? I don't know, about June or something. I don't know, before that, in Sweden. And what was interesting, there was a presentation about ABBA sales and how Mamma Mia had affected the sales. And basically, over the years, because of all the other projects that have come up, you know, including ABBA the Museum, Mamma Mia, and obviously the Voyage, the latest, that their sales of their back catalogue have massively gone up today to how the sales of their back catalogue were after their first existence.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the 80s were the dark ages for ABBA. No one was particularly interested. It wasn't cool to like ABBA. They weren't really... No one wrote about them. No one interviewed them as ABBA members, really. And there were, all these... The music was licensed out, it seemed, to anyone who would pay for it. And it was packaged, very shoddily, cassette tapes and compilations banged together without any thought. So definitely, because the music, like you say, through Mamma Mia and all these other projects, it's become much bigger now than it was back in the day. I mean, ABBA Gold has sold more than 32 million copies. And I think the best-selling album they had back then was sold 10 million or something. So it's all of those. And, but ABBA, it has become a franchise. You can almost call it a franchise because you have Mamma Mia, you have Mamma Mia the movie, you have Mamma Mia the party, which is this dinner restaurant, show concept. Like you said, you have the museum, you have Voyage, you have so many things that kind of remind people of, don't forget ABBA, as if.
When they came back together, how easy was it for them to gel in some way? Because obviously they had to come back together and then they would make a decision about making music, which I presume came a bit later. But how was it for them to actually meet again with all this history behind them?
Well, it's hard for me I wasn't there. I haven't been there at the meetings.
But you talked to them so much.
Well, from what they've said, I think it all felt very natural, because obviously after 40 years, they've gone through all kinds of ups and downs in terms of their relationship with their ABBA legacy, their relationship, within the group, how they relate to the four different members. I mean, so working together, what they said was, once they started recording together, it was like, oh, we were in the studio yesterday and now we're here again. It's like no time had passed at all. Everyone, Frida's, everyone was where they were supposed to be, behind the microphones or behind the mixing desk and things like that. So I think, it just felt very strange, but at the same time, very natural.
I mean, one of the strengths of ABBA were obviously the voices, the women's voices, and the harmonies that were created, and the strength through these voices. And what was surprising to me, because your voice does get weaker as you get older, and it doesn't really seem to notice. It's got a little bit deeper, I think, and that's it.
Yeah, it's a deeper, and it sounds their voices sound a little more frail here and there, but that's only, I think that's only attractive. That's just a different version of Agnetha and Frida, but it's still them. They clearly, haven't destroyed their voices with drink and drugs and, over the years they've kept in shape. So, yeah.
It's a fascinating book. As I said, it really had things in that I didn't know at all. And I wouldn't count myself as a massive ABBA fan, but I've definitely am. I definitely like ABBA. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But I'm not like, a maniac ABBA fan, but I like ABBA, definitely. And I really like so many of their songs. And as you say, that what you realised from doing these interviews and going back and actually, for this book, was to see that the girls had a real contribution to the music. And they would input in the recording studio. What else came out of compiling this book that made you realize that there was something more about ABBA that you initially knew from all these other books that you'd written?
Oh, dear. Well, I'm not sure there was anything really new to me as a writer. It's hard to say. There are so many things about them that are special. I would say nothing really new. I mean, as I was writing the final chapter, which is all about their comeback, you know, and the Voyage thing, the album and the digital avatar show, I was like, God, I still couldn't believe that it had happened. You know, because they'd said for so long, you know, we get along fine. We're not enemies. We don't hate each other. But ABBA was then and this is now when we're leading our lives. And, you know, the ladies had more, you know, more or less retired from show business. And so that was the, you know, the surprise. I was surprised even as I was writing it. Oh, did this really happen? Yeah, it did happen. They did record that album. It's just amazing to me.
I mean, so, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, about my interview when I went over to Sweden and went to their studio, and I think their studio, the roof come off, didn't it? I can't remember now. So I have this idea that the roof sort of would open, which I was very impressed with at the time. I remember at MTV, because this is the era of grunge and, you know, this sort of an MTV often about the people that work there would be into, you know, credible music and everything, and I was a bit of an outsider in terms of saying, well, I'd like, you know, I love ABBA and I love the Erasure versions and so on and so forth. How do you think their credibility has grown over the years, and how are they perceived today in relation to how they were perceived in their heyday?
It's undergone a massive change. It's completely different now. I mean, okay, even back in the day, it wasn't all bad reviews. They got you know, quite a lot of good reviews. They were their musicianship and their expert songwriting was recognized, but as an entity, it wasn't anything that your average music journalist at the time would want to identify with, and probably not today either. But as you know, grunge was probably the last time, I guess, when it was like, oh, we really mean it, man. You know, that kind of thing was felt to be important. Today, it's just a smorgasbord of, you know, music, and everyone picks and chooses however they want. You know, they listen to Kurt Cobain 1 minute and then they listen to ABBA the next, and it's nothing strange to them.
Exactly.
But yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. And Kurt Cobain was a huge ABBA fan. But today they are recognized as one of the big acts, one of the big popular music acts, and you can't ignore them. You can't ignore the quality of their best recordings, and so on and so forth. Whereas they were, some of the things they wrote especially in the British music press in the 1970s was, you know, really, really, really bad stuff. It was really condescending stuff. And like they were, you know, a gang of robots or something four Stepford Wives, except two of them were male, that kind of thing. No, so today it's completely different, but it's interesting because I started writing about ABBA about the same time when you did that interview on MTV. That's when I started, you know, going in depth on my research. And people said to me at the time, because my first book was a book called ABBA, The Complete Recording Sessions, which was about how they wrote and recorded their music and, you know, going in depth on that. And I remember some people said to me when I was like, you better hurry up with that before the ABBA revival dies down. I was like, yeah, well, we'll see about that. And then there was, you know, a second wave in the late 90s, and people were saying, you have a book coming out. Well, you better get it out before the revival dies down. But after that, since then, I haven't heard that. And also at that time, it was like, why do you want to write about ABBA? And you could feel, you know, that's why a klutz like me got to take this position that I still have, is because no one else was doing it. No one else was interested. Now, 30 years later, I see all these, you know, credible music journalists going out there and, you know, talking about ABBA and interviewing ABBA. And so it's completely different.
Well, that's wonderful. What's your favorite ABBA track?
Oh, God. If I have to choose one, I usually choose The Winner Takes It All. That's the one I return to, but I have so many. I mean, you know, I could compile a top 10 for you and that would be more fair, but let's say The Wind Takes It All. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say, Give Me a Man After Midnight, but actually it's not, it's
the message is nicer.
That's it. It is definitely The Day Before You Came, which I just absolutely adore. I think it's just such a great track and the tone of it and the quality of it. And
oh yeah. Yeah. It's up there. It's up there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a really brilliant track. Well, I want to thank you because this has been a fascinating talk. Your book is incredible. And it really is for anyone who's interested in ABBA in the slightest to find out much more about them. And I think unless you're an absolute, you know, ABBA maniac, you're not going to know half the things in the book. So thank you for writing this book. And thank you also, because I think it's really important that there's a real contribution to music history from journalists like yourself. So Carl Magnus Palm, thank you very much. And I look forward to many more books about ABBA and the revival continuing over the next years.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed this chat.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.